This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, this is Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. As forests and natural spaces shrink and human activities increasingly expand and encroach on wildlife habitats, human-wildlife conflicts are practically inevitable. It's a complex issue, one with underlying cultural, political and economic aspects that sometimes shape these conflicts and further complicate solutions to these issues. The key, of course, is to look for balanced solutions to coexist and adapt different methods to different situations. So the Animal Neighbours Project is a community-based project that uses research and education to mitigate human-wildlife conflict in urban areas in particular. And today on the show, I'm going to find out more from Dr. Shamini Jalitha Paramasivam. She's a senior academic at the University of Surrey. She's a veterinarian, and she's also the founder and project lead of the Animal Neighbours Project. Welcome, Shamini. How are you today?
I'm good. Hi.
Thank you so much for joining me. So just so everyone knows, Dr. Shamini is actually joining me all the way from UK. So as I mentioned, you're a senior academic at the University of Surrey, and that's where you're currently based now, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So I teach full-time at the University of Surrey while managing the project in Malaysia.
Okay. And we're going to find out more about that, of course. So Animal Neighbours Project is your brainchild, I believe.
Yes.
What made you want to start it in the first place?
I think the reason to start it was just the need. We had increased number of reports about conflict and what was happening with the macaques, and we didn't have an avenue at that point. So we really needed something. And I was working in Indonesia on macaques as well, but macaques and rehabilitation. And so I just felt that there was a need for us to have a community-based project so that we can work with the community to try and come up with strategies that are feasible in the long term. So it's not just us saying, okay, this is what needs to be done, but it's the community that also works with us to drive the strategies.
Mm-hmm. And Animal Neighbours Project, I think I didn't mention that in the introduction, it focuses specifically on macaques, am I correct?
That's right. I mean, the reason why we call it Animal Neighbours is because it's not meant to be just for macaques. It's meant to be for pretty much any animal. But I think at the moment, the need is really for the macaques, and that's where we're focusing a lot of our energy and resources on. We're far from where we should be. So we're still working on the macaques. But, you know, moving forward, we would be quite pleased to work on other animals and try and coexist with other wild animals. But for the time being, that's right, we're just working on macaques.
Mm-hmm. And macaques have a special place in your heart, if I'm correct in saying that. And you did do a lot of work in Indonesia with macaques, right? Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, so what I did was I was studying, while doing my master's, I knew I wanted to study primates, and specifically on the non-flagship species. And of course, coming from Malaysia, I was very keen on macaques. And I got an opportunity to do my research on macaques in rehabilitation in Indonesia with an amazing organization, International Animal Rescue. And what I was doing was I was studying them in rehabilitation. So in a lot of countries, macaques are kept as pets. And after they reach a certain age where they're sexually matured, you know, they start becoming just like people would. You know, a female macaque might become very protective of a male owner, would be a bit more aggressive towards a female owner, and so that people don't want them anymore. Mm. Or, you know, it just becomes cumbersome to keep a primate, because you can imagine they become really active. And so when they don't want them, then, you know, IAR takes them and we rehabilitate them. So my study was looking at them in rehabilitation, trying to see how can we basically turn them from little baby children to actual monkeys back again, and what's the best methodology to do that, and to make sure that their welfare is managed, because, you know, rehabilitation is not something that happens quickly. It happens over, you know, a couple of years. And what kind of behavior? So looking at their natural behavior and how can we mimic them in captivity, which was really fun. So I did that research with them, and shortly after they took me on to work with them. So I was then their head vet for a couple of years, mm-hmm. working on rehabilitation of macaques and lorises. And I had the time of my life.
Lovely. And I think it's a huge problem, right? The illegal pet trade and all of that. These are all contributing factors to the kind of the work that you were doing there as well.
Yeah, they're definitely. So illegal pet trade, the more people see animals, you know, they see a little cute thing, they want to keep it. So it's the illegal pet trade, and then it leads into conflict as well.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, here, I'm sure you've heard here in Malaysia, you know, not just macaques, it's gibbons as well, even sun bears. We found sun bears in an apartment here in KL somewhere. You know, it's crazy, the kind of things that, and of course, then when people can't deal with it, that's when the problem starts. So the Animal Neighbours Project, you know, it's your brainchild, of course. And I understand it's run both in Malaysia and also in the UK. Could you explain how it works exactly? And I guess how both kind of differ or complement each other?
Yeah, sure. So when you think about the idea of human-animal conflict or interaction, it's about where the problem is, and it's mostly with either, you know, the local community that are facing this problem. So we work, the project in Malaysia works with the local community, with the local councils to try and create, you know, some kind of strategy. But at the same time, we quickly realized that there's also the idea of tourists. So tourists will come into the country and have a very different perception on macaques. So while we as Malaysians, we might say, oh, you know, this is the normal carer that we see all the time by the side of the road. But for a tourist who doesn't see monkeys, they get super, super excited. So when they see a monkey, they want to feed it, right?
Right.
And they want to have a really close interaction, have them on their lands. So that quickly made us realize that we need to work from two angles, from the local side of things, but also from the tourist side, the international tourists. And because we were based in the UK teaching at the university, we came up with this idea of starting it here in the UK. And that got a lot of traction with quite a few of my students. And in fact, I've had some volunteers, you know, for the past 5 years who has now taken over leading the Animal Neighbours Project in the UK.
Okay.
So the project in the UK focuses mainly on awareness with young children, going to schools, talking about wildlife in countries that aren't, you know, things that they will see in their own country.
Okay.
And also how to be a responsible tourist. So we try and get them to pledge, you know, like what they should be doing and what they shouldn't be doing as tourists. Okay. And the idea is that I always believe if you change the mindset of one individual in the family, especially a child, you change the family.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen it happen time and time again. You know, if you can, if a child says, no, I don't want to take a picture next to this monkey, or no, no, I don't want to feed the monkey, then the family won't necessarily go close to the animal. So that's how we're currently working. And of course, in Malaysia, there's a lot more things to do. So we work on trying to come up with strategies, trying to work with the local community to try and improve the welfare of both for people as well as for the monkeys, you know, because we have to remember it's not just about the animals, it's also about people and how they struggle with having these negative interactions with wild animals. So with negative interactions, so we've sort of moved from calling it human-animal conflict to calling it human-animal interface or human-animal interaction. And that's because when you think about conflict, it's two parties that have a problem with each other.
Yeah.
And actually, you know, the wildlife have no problem except for the lack of space. They don't have, they're not uncomfortable or trying to get back at us.
Mm.
You know, they're not doing things like raiding bins. I don't like using that terminology because that would imply that they have an intention. I want to get to the bin and I want to destroy a property. But to them, they're just living their life. You know, it's foraging. It's bin foraging. They are going into a bin because that's where they can get their food. So coming back to it is, using the word conflict generally is inappropriate or probably less accurate.
Okay.
So we use human-animal interface or interaction because it's a little bit more accurate in what it's trying to do. But the idea is that there's a lot of negative interaction between people and these monkeys. And there's multiple reasons why this is happening. One of it is, of course, the lack of space, right?
Yeah.
The more that we develop and the lack of planning that we have when we develop just means that these animals lose their homes overnight. And some animals struggle with it. We've seen that with the orangutans. They struggle. They don't know where to go. But macaques are the true emblem of resilience because they will learn how to cope with the situation. You know, if you reduce their space, which is really sad, they will learn, okay, look, how can I try and make it, you know, how can I keep the family surviving?
Yeah.
And so they move into more urban spaces, which is why there's a need for us to tackle it from an urban space as well as a rural space. So we've got this issue of lack of space, which very difficult to tackle.
Yeah.
But there's also issues of what's drawing them in. So looking at motivation, which is what we do, is we look at what's the reason for the complaints, and we look at what's the motivation for the animals coming in. Now, the motivation can be anything, and it's usually resource-driven. Yeah? So if you think about it now, communities are becoming very green. Mm-hmm. We want to grow vegetables. We want to grow fruit trees in our gardens, which is a great thing to do from a human perspective. But if you live in an area where there's wildlife, you can bet that this is going to be a reason for the wildlife to come in.
Of course.
So this you know, it seems really simple, but this is what draws these animals in. And of course, when they come in, they're not going to just come and pluck the fruits and be like, thank you very much, bye-bye. They're going to hang out there. The young ones are going to start playing, you know, pulling on the wire. Monkeys are really socially interactive animals. So if you've got wires, if you've got a little dog or a little cat, they will interact with all of this. And that means damage to your property. You know, we have communities, and I really, really feel for them, that have spent thousands every year just fixing cables or roof tiles because the monkeys are coming into their area to chill out because there's fruit trees all over. So what we do is we try and understand why are they coming to these areas and how can we draw out a plan to keep them wild and to coexist. So the idea is not to get rid of the wildlife or to get rid of the people because it's not realistic.
Yeah.
The idea is how can we coexist together? How can we be neighbors? You know, the whole idea of being neighbors is that you don't want to get too close. If you're too close, you start finding fault, right? So you just want to be like, okay, hello, how are you? Bye-bye.
Yep.
And that's it. You know, you see your wild neighbor and you're like, yep, you're there. I will just do my thing. You do your thing. Fine. No complaints.
Respect your boundaries and I respect yours and we're okay, right? Pretty much.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's really sad when you think about what Perhelitan has these numbers out in their annual report, and they get about 4,000 plus complaints about macaques alone on a yearly basis. And when you level that out, that's about 400 complaints in a month just for macaques. So they have to be seen to be doing something, and people want quick actions. You know, they want the macaques gone immediately.
Yeah.
They want the problem solved. And that leads to poor management strategies like culling. Mm. Because, you know, translocation is nice. We want to translocate, but translocate where? You know, each macaque family is about 100 individuals. So you can imagine trying to catch a family of 100 and move them. It's very unrealistic.
Mm.
So culling is sadly used as a strategy. And I can see why, because everybody wants things quick. So we're working with the wildlife authorities as well to try and manage this in a welfare-friendly manner.
Okay, all right. We're just going to go for a quick break, Dr. Sharmini. When we come back, maybe let's find out more about those methods that you were talking about. I'm speaking today to Dr. Sharmini Julitha Paramasivam. She's a veterinarian. She's the founder and project lead of the Animal Neighbours Project. She's also a senior academic at the University of Surrey. We're finding out more about the Animal Neighbours Project and how we can best mitigate human-wildlife... interface? It's not... Interface or interactions. We don't want to use the word conflict anymore. And we'll have more after this quick break. You're listening to Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture. I'm Juliet Jacobs. Joining me on the line today, all the way from the UK, is Dr. Sharmini Julitha Paramasivam. She's a veterinarian. She's the founder and project lead of the Animal Neighbours Project. She's also a senior academic at the University of Surrey. And we are finding out more about that project that she founded, which is the Animal Neighbours Project. And it's basically to sort of, mitigate human-wildlife interactions, you know, as we increasingly encroach into their space. Of course, they are coming into our space. How do we find a peaceful coexistence, I suppose, right? That's what we're looking for. So, Sharmini, before the break, you know, you explained why these things are happening in the first place, why all these human-wildlife interactions are increasing. So you mentioned some of the methods that you guys are exploring, also with the wildlife authorities here in Malaysia. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Sure. Yeah, so what we do is we use research and education to come up with this strategy. So the first thing is we try and work with communities that have got a high level of complaints. So they will come to us and they'll say, you know, like I've got issues with macaques in our area. What do we do? And we work with them to first try and find out what's actually happening. Because from one person's perspective, it might mean the macaques are coming to my house. But it might be actually a few doors down the lane, you've got a nice rambutan tree. And this is actually a real situation where we had macaques coming into one community. It was an apartment. And that's very, very strange for macaques to be traveling at such a high floor. Mm. And when we mapped it out, we realized that in the area nearby, there was a local resident who retired recently and started actively growing trees all around the neighborhood, which is a great idea.
Yep.
But during rambutan season, which is the macaques, one of their favorite things, they would travel. So they would travel past this condominium to get to this rambutan. So it's very important for us to know what's actually happening, where the problem is, you know, anyone feeding directly or indirectly. So first thing we do is we talk to the community and we establish what we call a local action group. Mm-hmm. And a local action group is any stakeholder that's involved in that area. It can be residents, it can be the local council, it can be vendors, anyone that's vested or struggling with a problem in that area.
Okay.
So that means we then work as a group and we do some citizen science. So we collect data from the residents to just say when they're seeing these animals, what's the actual problem. And then we also go to the ground and we start to look at what the actual scenario is like. Once we get a picture, we then decide, we have a plan on what the strategies can be. Some strategies can be very straightforward, like, you know, there's a lot of bin foraging in that area. So the first thing to do is we need to secure bins. Just stop the motivation for these animals to come.
Right.
Some of it might be that the monkeys are actually using tree branches to jump from one house to the other. Mm-hmm. So if we trim the tree branch just slightly, then they may not come to the ground because there is no connection. So they just stop from the movement. So it just depends what the situation in every area is unique. Because you have to think about, is there local tourists coming? Is there international tourists coming? Are there people actively coming to feed? So we look at all these different factors and then we have a plan, which can be also frustrating because, as you can imagine, it doesn't happen overnight.
Of course.
It takes, you know, a lot of research and a lot of awareness to talk about monkeys. And one thing I want to highlight as well, people's intentions are not always bad. We always think people have the wrong intentions, but they actually, a lot of times from my experience, have got the right intentions. They want to help the animals. So people put out fruits and food for these animals because they feel, oh no, very, you know, kasihan, they don't have enough food. There's no forest.
Yeah.
What they fail to understand is that these animals don't eat fruits that we eat. You know, they don't eat mangoes and oranges and apples. If you look at them in the wild, they go for very low energy things, shrubs, little flowers, insects. And that keeps that nice balance between their reproductive. There's been research to show the higher the energy, the quicker the reproductive. Oh. So what we're actually doing by feeding them human fruits is we're getting them sexually active quicker. And they can create more babies. You know, so we're not actually helping the situation that way. So these are all the things that we do. You know, we look at the behavior of the animals, we look at the behavior of the people from a social science perspective, and then we come up with strategies and also come up with an awareness.
Okay, that's really interesting, Sharmini. And I think, you know, some of us, like you said, well-meaning people, we give them things like bread, you know, high-carb sort of food, which is, you know, nothing in their natural diet, right? And then that will also, I'm guessing, will also affect their mood and their behavior and things like that. Am I correct in saying that?
Yeah, completely through. It affects their gut as well. You know, we don't know what the effect of this long-term eating of human fruits has done. But when some of the work that we were doing in Indonesia, when we took these animals on the pet trade, we had one that, you know, collapsed and died on the table. And when we did a post-mortem, he was basically just covered in fat. I had never seen anything like this, you know. So, you know, that naturally doesn't occur in the wild because they are active, they are eating low energy food. But this individual obviously had been eating a lot of high energy things. So, you know, it's not great for them because they end up being obese, they end up more sick, and it's not healthy for the animals.
Yeah, okay. There's so much that we don't understand, isn't it? We think we're doing the right thing, then we're not. And that's my next question, actually. How do you get the community? So you mentioned how you work together with the authorities, but how about the community? You know, how do you get them involved? Any stories with regard to that?
Yeah. So we, like I said, we first speak to them. Sure. And that's a key thing, is trying to be very neutral, because people tend to think, you know, oh, you're pro-animal, and so you come from one perspective, but that's not true. Mm. Because I think it's really important to understand the human perspective as well, you know, to have some people, some of our local action groups, they do struggle. They find it difficult to come out of the house if the monkeys are in the garden.
Sure.
They are worried about their dogs. You know, they might have a small dog versus like a big German Shepherd, and they're worried about the safety of their dog if the dog is in the garden. So it's very important to get that information from both sides, if you like. You know, we look at the behavior from the animal, but we also then understand what people are going through. And we try and come up with solutions that help both sides. And the community, you know, we talk to them, we get data from them. We also get feedback from them. So we created, through the community, a novel latch, a bin latch that is monkey-proof. Mm-hmm. So you screw it onto your bin, and, you know, a person can open it, but a monkey can't. And we have trial and tested this by putting, you know, fruits in the bin and leaving it in different areas and watching. And it's definitely monkey-proof, because okay, they weren't able to open it. Mm-hmm. But it was important to get the feedback from the residents. And we tested it to make sure that they were comfortable with it. They, you know, they agreed to using this. So it's important to get the feedback from the community. And sometimes, you know, people get fed up. Like, it's taking too long, Shamini. You know, you've been here working with us for over a year. Monkeys are still coming to my garden. And they might go down a different route to try and solve it themselves. And it's important that we still have a relationship with them.
Sure.
You know, because they might come around after that and say, look, it didn't work, let's work together again. Okay. So it's always important to have that open communication with the local action groups, and constantly get them involved. And so they feel a part of the effort. And I've really enjoyed that part of the work. And I'm a veterinarian. I'm a scientist with, you know, I work on monkey behavior, animal behavior. But over the years, I've really, really enjoyed the interaction with people, because that's a huge part of the work that we do.
I'm thinking rude thoughts a lot that, you know, well, how different are the humans from the monkeys, really? But never mind. I will make you answer that question. So there are solutions, basically, isn't it, to sort of coexist? There's no one size fits all, as you said. You have to go into the communities, assess the situation, do like mapping and things like that, and mitigate based on the scenarios that are present in each of these different communities.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly it.
Okay.
There is no one size that fits all. But what we would like to do is come up with almost like a formula. So if you think about it, like in a residential area, you know, with X number of people, what kind of land size, this might be a strategy. If these are the problems that they're facing, this might be a strategy. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And if it's, say, in another area where there's tourists, there's this other issues, what, and they have certain problems, X might be a strategy. So if we can gather all this information, we would like to map it out so that we can give people solutions that are sort of suited towards their area.
Okay. All right. And I guess, you know, I'm sure, and I can speak from experience. I was telling you, you know, off air earlier, you know, my neighborhood, so many, you know, the two different camps, like those who want the macaques exterminated, those who want to try and find ways to coexist peacefully. Is the option there for us to get in touch with you, you know, communities to get in touch with you and, you know, try and find ways to mitigate all these different problems with wildlife?
Yeah, I'm glad that you brought it up, because a lot of times the work that we're doing is not just human-animal conflict, but also human-human conflict as well.
I
think
monkeys.
It just goes hand in hand.
Yep.
But yeah, you know, we've visit our website, send us an email, or Facebook message us, whatever message on social media. Just get in touch with us, because we would like to work with more communities, but equally, we also need more ambassadors in this area.
Okay. So if anyone would like to get involved, just get in touch with you, you know, whatever method there is. So I know you guys are on Facebook. What other channels do you guys have?
Facebook, Instagram, and email, I guess.
Email. Okay. All right.
Yeah.
And I guess, you know, what are some other plans that you have moving forward? You're still growing it, obviously, right? What are some of the plans in the pipeline?
Well, the plan is to grow the team. Mm-hmm. I mean, we started this project many years ago, but macaques aren't the flagship species. So we always struggle with funding. We struggle with people taking us seriously. So we really would like to grow that perspective of growing a team with different expertise. Mm-hmm. So not just animal scientists, but, you know, social scientists, educators, a different group of individuals. Also to get more funding. So try and get more long-term funding so we can keep the individuals that we bring on board for an extended period as well.
Mm-hmm.
And also to work with communities at an earlier stage. Right now, we get to the point where people are complaining and they've had this problem for, you know, the past 15 odd years.
Mm-hmm.
And it can obviously it's more challenging, but we want to try and work with communities early on and also work with developers. So my dream is always to work with developers where we can get to this stage, if they're developing, that we can plan. You know, this is near a very green area. How can we create a buffer zone? How do we design this plans, urban plans, taking into consideration the wildlife that will be crossing those areas?
Sure.
You know, so for example, like in Singapore and many other countries that have created the wildlife crossing in their
corridors, right?
Yeah, the corridors in their highway. Is these kind of things where it only works if we start planning with the developers. So I would like to get to that stage where we're not cleaning up a mess, but we're preventing the mess from happening.
Okay, that's excellent. I mean, I think this is really important work. I mean, yeah, maybe macaques are not the most iconic or, you know, the prettiest, I suppose, right? Species, not the orangutans, but they are right here. I mean, my office is in Taman Tun. I can see them, you know, from my office, you know, kind of running around. They're right there. We are already living with them. How do we coexist peacefully, pretty much, right? Yeah.
Yeah. And actually, I need to just point out that because we see them in the fringe, you know, we always see them around rural areas. We think that they're in large numbers, and that's not the case at all. Uh-huh. Macaques are actually, the numbers are dwindling. 10, 20 years from now, I think, you know, our next generation will be lucky if they get to see macaques, because the numbers are reducing significantly.
Oh.
The IUCN as well, they used to be classified as least concern. Now they are classified as vulnerable. And so it's like they're moving closer and closer towards being in danger. So we must do something, you know, to help that. Just because we see them, it's because they have one family is large.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it doesn't mean there are many families around. And they are so unique. You know, they are... I feel very sad when people say that, oh, just the monkey, just the kura, because they are so intelligent. I am obsessed with how intelligent and how they are. They can adapt and manipulate things to survive.
Fine, or
just just their interaction. It's so unique. It's so interesting, and you know, people should experience that and learn the type of interactions that they have.
Okay. It's really interesting that you say that, because it's so true. You know, whenever I go for walks with friends or whatever, we go into sort of like forested areas, they're like, clearly one species is not doing badly at all. But as you pointed out, that is actually a misconception. That's so interesting. I don't think people realize that.
Yeah, exactly. So we try it now. I think that's something we're also trying to create an awareness. And I think the IUCN group also is doing that, is trying to highlight that, you know, macaques, there aren't a lot of them around. We need to start looking after them.
Okay, we need to learn to coexist peacefully. Okay, all right.
Exactly, yes.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today. Before I let you go, any last message that you'd like to leave us with?
No. Well, just to remind anybody who's listening, you know, if you're interested, do contact us, whether you're struggling with a situation or if you're keen to, you've got a couple of hours a week that you want to help us. You know, we do need more people on board. So, and having more people definitely will increase the enthusiasm for these species as well.
Okay. All right. And as you mentioned, you know, just look for you guys on social media or just go to your website. You've got a lovely website, animalneighborsproject.org. Am I correct?
That's right. Yes. Yeah. So on Facebook or Instagram, just send us a message and then we'll get in touch.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. I've been speaking to Dr. Sharmini Jalita Paramasivam. She's a veterinarian. She's an academic at the University of Surrey, and she is also the founder and project lead of the Animal Neighbours Project. Basically, they are looking at ways to mitigate human-wildlife, interactions. I keep wanting to say conflicts. Human-wildlife interactions and how we can all learn to coexist peacefully. Again, just search for the Animal Neighbours Project on social media or online if you'd like to find out more. And if you miss any part of today's interview or any previous Earth Matters interviews, you can download the podcasts at bfm.my/earth, or you can find it on the BFM app. This has been Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.